Bismillah. So we have some guests tonight, I think probably owed to Fred's enthusiasm after his recent journey to places in the East. And anyway, thank you for coming. It's good to meet you. And we will try and say a few words to give a little context of what we're doing here. And this is not a beginner's night, and I don't consider any of you beginners anyway, but sort of entering in midstream of a long stream, a stream of centuries, I suppose. And, you know, we are a tradition that traces back to Rumi, and even further back, really it's a tradition of the prophets, as far back as they go, which is all the way. And at the same time, we are a tradition, and it's a tradition that has its context, its teachings, its format, and it also has its universal dimension. A tradition which is complete and comprehensive will lead to a universal understanding, God willing. So I'm preparing some teachings on the subject of friendship with God. And this has a particular meaning in Sufism and in Islam, because the word that we have for a saint, that would translate as saint, is the friend of God. The word in Arabic, Turkish and Farsi, etc., is Wali. Actually, there are two divine names that are very close. One is, listen carefully for the difference, Wali and Wali. Wali and Wali. So Wali means, it has the meaning of the one who oversees, who governs, who is in some authority. And a supporter. And Wali is the one who is near to God, or near to anything. But insofar as Wali is a name of God, God is near to us. Not only near to us, but it implies nearness not in terms of physical proximity, but nearness in every sense. So people discover this aspect of the divine in the course of their lives. People of faith, that is. I don't mean people of belief. I mean people of faith. People who acknowledge and perceive that we live in a spiritual reality. Arrive at that conviction because of unfolding events in life, in which we discover that there is some kind of guidance operating, that it's not a meaningless, arbitrary existence, that in fact there seems to be some kind of intelligence and even protection, and if I may say so, mercy operating in existence. And when I say mercy, don't confuse it with the idea, Lord, have mercy on me, a miserable sinner. I'm not talking about that kind of mercy. I'm talking about the tenderness of the universe. Beautiful, compassionate nurturing at the heart of existence that sometimes we only experience through suffering, through challenges, as well as through the sweetness of life. So we'll ignore that phone. It'll stop eventually. So next week we'll be going to Garrison, New York, and we'll have a 4-day retreat there on this theme called being a friend of God, calling practical Sufism. And so tonight we'll offer sort of previews and coming attractions of that future, and together reflect on what it might mean to be God's friend, and also to know that the divine is our friend. I will share the quotes I'm going to share with you. I'll give to you later in written form, but I'm not going to ask you to read it now. It'll just distract. But let me begin with this verse from the Quran, which is an important one in a way. It gives a context. You know, we have a reference point in Sufism, and that ultimate reference point is the Quran, which is considered a revelation from a very pure intelligence. Here is what it says. Truly, they who are near to God, no fear need they have, and neither shall they grieve. They who have attained to faith and have always been conscious of the divine being, for them there is assurance in the life of this world and in the life to come. And since nothing could ever alter the outcome of God's promises, this is the supreme attainment. Truly, those who are near to God, they will not have fear nor grief. And those who have attained to faith and have always been conscious of God, of the divine being, for them there is assurance in the life of this world and in the world to come. Now, if you were to compare this to other translations, you would definitely note some differences. I actually I think this is my own translation, and there are a few words that were interesting to me. For instance, Muhammad Asad would have translated, for them there is glad tidings. Okay, we understand what that is. Although if you look up tidings in Microsoft Word thesaurus, it won't recognize it at all. So I thought, if it doesn't recognize it, how many people, maybe this word is, you know, obsolete. So, but instead of glad tidings, I chose the word assurance. I struggled. Should it be hope? Should it be promise? Should it be assurance? The meaning is since there's nothing to fear and nothing to grieve about for those who are near to the divine reality. This is an assurance. And it's not about the afterlife alone, but it's also about the afterlife. But it's definitely about this life. This life and the life. So this gives us a frame, a nice frame of reference. And the word here, truly those who are near to God, for those of you, the word here is awliya. We have, Sarah, we have a nice, beautiful seat for you right here in front. And Kasim, don't hide. I'm going to pick on you. You could, if you like, squeeze in between these two gentlemen. Choose a seat, but bring it close, because that's all we're talking about tonight is closeness. There's no foreignness tonight. We don't allow foreignness. No distances in divine reality. This is 10, 62, 64. There are only a few places where the awliya occurs in the Quran, and both of them are very important. And one of them I would like to have a banner made up, and I'd like to have some commandos stretch it across various mosques in the world, including in the United States, especially those where they push the women away and hide them behind screens and whatnot. Because the other occurrence of Awliya says, the men of faith and the women of faith are Awliya for each other. And no one, I don't know how they mistranslate that in so many ways, but it's a beautifully significant and powerful statement. The faithful men and the faithful women are saints for each other. So what are we doing putting the women, you know, behind a screen somewhere? You know, men especially need the company, the example of women, the gentleness, the refinement of women. So those, I think, are the two major occasions of this word. So I told you there's wali and wali, and the word we're primarily concerned with is wali. But even this has two distinct meanings. It has a passive sense and an active sense. The passive sense of wali, when applied to people, I mean, we can apply it to God, but right now we're going to apply it to human beings. And because we are the ones who, when we understand that God is our friend, that impels us towards closeness with the divine. That makes us want to be in that state of nearness, in that closeness. And as I said, it's not physical closeness primarily, it's the closeness of like your most intimate friend and companion. So applied to us, there is a passive sense of being the friend of God. And the passive sense is that, now may I remind us, I'm talking about sainthood. May you all be saints. All find your way to that proximity. But we're talking about a very high state. So the passive sense here of being the friend of God is that you entrust your life and everything about it to Him. That's it. It doesn't mean you become passive or fatalistic. But for the true saint, such a person lives in a state where the reason they have no fear or grief is because they've turned it all over to the divine. And they have entrusted themselves to divine guidance, to divine protection, to divine intelligence. And that intelligence will even operate through the human being. To give you an example, now I'll quote from Rumi. He says again, in the saint who is the owner of the divine breath, there is a soul and intelligence other than human. What would that be like? There's a spiritual intelligence in the saint, in the friend. Then he says, the souls of wolves and dogs are separate, each one. But the souls of the lions of God are in union. He's telling us that the saints who have the divine breath, they don't live in separation as animals do, but they are the lions of God and they are one. Some way they are one. So, the passive sense of wali, of the friend, is that you've given it up, you've given it over, you've given your life over to that one. That's what I meant when I said this is a very high state. Who can really do that? Who really does do that in every moment? To the extent that you never turn away. There is no inner rebellion. There is no resistance, no resentment, no fear, no doubting that that intelligence and that grace is enough for us. The other active sense of it applies to the one who is so actively faithful that they do the actions of worship, of spiritual practice, of service, of all these actions that a human being can do in this world in order to express that friendship. The true friend of God embodies both of these meanings. Giving your life over and also expressing it in your actions, in your generosity, in your service, in your worship, in your faithfulness to your spiritual practice. There are some beautiful sayings from the tradition, from some very old Sufis, that I wanted to share with you. One of them is from a man named Al-Karaz, probably 1,000 years ago. He lays it out very nicely. He lays out a whole series of stages. He says, when God wishes to befriend one of his servants, he opens for him the gate of remembrance. And when that servant experiences the sweetness of remembrance, God opens for him or her the gate of nearness. Then God raises that one to the gatherings of his intimacy. People used to think like this, you know. They used to see the world this way. He raises him or her to the gatherings of his intimacy. Then he settles him upon the throne of unity. You can only wildly guess what this means, or maybe you know. Then he lifts the veil and leads his servant into the abode of unity and reveals for him the divine splendor and majesty. And when the servant's eyes fall upon the divine splendor and majesty, nothing of himself remains. Then the servant is entirely annihilated for a time. After this, he comes under God's exalted protection, free from any pretensions of self. So this is a kind of map, isn't it? With quite a few stages. It's quite a... The first one is really quite a blessing. When God wishes to befriend one of his servants, he opens for him the gate of his remembrance. You know, for those of you who are newer here, remembrance, which is zikr in various languages, is the fundamental practice of this path. It's the remembrance of God with the heart. It's not thinking about God. It's not quoting scripture in your brain. It is opening the aperture of the heart to experience the divine presence. You like to hear these stages again, quickly? Opens the gate of his remembrance until he or she experiences the sweetness of remembrance. And then, after the sweetness, you experience the nearness. And then with the nearness, you're invited into the gatherings of his intimacy. And then he settles you upon the throne of unity. And then he lifts the veil and leads you into the abode of unity and reveals the divine splendor and majesty. Human being is capable of inner experiences of infinite dimensions. And when his eyes fall upon the divine splendor and majesty, nothing of himself remains, and he's or she is effaced or annihilated. Actually, effaced is probably a better word, for a time, not forever. And then he comes under God's exalted protection. Now here we're back to Wali, the protector. The friend is also the protector, as well as the friend. And I like the way he says it, free from any pretensions of self. That's an interesting phrase, because he's not saying free of the pretentiousness of self. That pretentiousness was presumably lost a long time ago. But here the pretensions of self are something subtler than that. Thank you, Al-Kharaz. Kharaz. Now, there was another brother, Yahya ibn Mu'adh, who describes the friend of God in this way. This will make more sense after what I just read. They are servants clothed with intimacy with God Most High. They embrace what follows after suffering, striving even as they arrive at the station of sainthood. And he continues, the saints do nothing for the sake of men's approval, nor are they hypocritical. God takes over their affairs so that, by his supervision, lights appear within them without interruption. A friend of God is not beset with the thought of himself or herself, nor do they take comfort from anything but God. The saint is a fragrant plant placed in the earth by God. How beautiful. The saint is a fragrant plant. You like that, don't you? Placed in the earth by God. And the truthful ones benefit from this fragrance. And it comes into their hearts so that they long for him. In other words, other human beings catching the fragrance of the saint, longing to be closer to that, which is just a hint of the divine friendship. As their hearts long for that, they increase their worship and practice according to their different temperaments. So, this is a little bit of how tradition views what is possible for a human being. In all these years, actually, we've never touched on this subject. Well, there's so many beautiful subjects and so many beautiful perspectives on our humanness and our relationship with the divine, but why did it take us so many years to get here? I know you all haven't been here for all those years, but we're finally getting around to talking about Wali, the friend, the divine friend, and us as those who become capable of that nearness. So how will we become more capable of that nearness? Should we make the next month, should we make the intention during the month of October, which is coming up, to reflect on this, to explore this as a possibility, so that in our busy lives we ask ourselves, am I coming nearer or am I going further away? And how may I come nearer? J. just before the meeting, I was reflecting on, I was asking myself, is there a phrase that could be offered that might help us with this intention? And I went through many iterations and said, because language can should be used, when possible, used intentionally and skillfully. You might find something that suits you better, but the phrase that came to me was, I offer my heart to the friend. And if we were to remind ourselves of that proposition, perhaps 7 times a day, randomly, at random times or at specific times, just to remind ourselves, I offer my heart to the friend. Maybe we would discover what that means. Maybe we would actually turn our hearts towards the infinite. Maybe we would begin to notice where our hearts had been turned away or turned toward. We need to see. I offer my heart to the friend. As I said, if you like this, take it. If you come up with something better, by all means, take that. But one of the ways we can benefit from this teaching and our own togetherness is by having a theme that we hold together, and we can share our experience and reflections of that theme over the coming weeks, at least the weeks when we will be here, but we will be traveling a bit again. But to have some reference point for our inner work and for our observations of how we're living, what we're conscious of, and what our mind is doing. Sufism is something very practical. It's not a philosophy to be read. It's not merely poetry to be appreciated. It's not a specialization for some, shall we say, very sublime, refined, and rare person. It's not for everybody, but it is essentially about awakening and developing our latent human capacities in order to be more completely in relationship with what is real, by which we mean the divine. I offer my heart to the divine, or simply I offer my heart to you. Yes, Mo. You want me to give you the answer?
What was the question?
He said, but what would that mean? He said, what would that mean? Well, let me see. Is there something I could clarify about the question that's unclear? Or do you just want the answer from me rather than from yourself? Put the question in the light of everything that's been said tonight, and there's your answer on one level, right? Okay, but let me just give you some more to reflect on. The heart of the human being is so precious that everything in the universe wants to be in that heart, including politicians, people who want to sell you something, celebrities. Everything is vying for possession of your heart. Did you know that? And so where is the gatekeeper of your heart? Where is that which can decide? I'll take this into my heart, but I don't think I need to let something else occupy my heart, because my heart is fully occupied with, for instance, resentment, jealousy, conflicting desires, etc. The heart is full. Is there room for... What about the friend? What did we just read here? I'm looking for... A friend of God is not beset with the thought of himself or herself, nor do they take comfort from anything other than God. They do nothing for the sake of men's approval, nor are they hypocritical. God takes over their affairs so that by that supervision, lights appear within them without interruption. So you'll have this page and look at it. I put it in this way. I offer my heart to the friend because to me it seemed the most, you know, an active, tangible option. Because it suggests, and the word offer is a good, and it's a good word, it's a strong word, offer. You could say give, but offer is not in the sense of a business offer, but more in the sense of a sacramental offering. An offering, it's a good ritualistic kind of word. So I offer my heart. Here. Does the divine want it? Well, find out. So the heart is your most precious essence. It's your everything. It's the only thing that matters, ultimately. Rumi says, in a poem, Rumi puts this in God's voice. God says to the servant, consult your heart. If it is pleased with you, I am pleased with you. Your heart pleased with you. If your heart is pleased with you, then God is pleased with you too. Take that as a kind of axiom or proposal. There's a lot more could be said about this. I don't want to say it all. Just enough to open a possibility. Remember, the intention is to understand our nearness with the real, to say it another way, and to open ourselves to the nearness from the real. It goes both ways, it must. So it's another way of seeing your spiritual practice, your worship, your service. Make sense, Minha? You understand. She understands. See, as people get older, they forget. They forget what you know naturally. So how old are you, Minha? Beautiful age. Sweet age. Old enough to be wise. Young enough to be wise. Any other thoughts or questions? Yes, Barry.
Just I offer my heart to you. My heart is both the most precious aspect of myself and potentially the most delicate. Who would I trust with it?
Exactly. The only one worthy of trust. Exactly. Yah Wakil. You know? It's another divine name, Wakil. It means the trustee. The only one worthy of trust. And the word for surrender in Sufi language is Tawakul. Comes from Wakil. So there's only one worthy of trust. Only one who... there's incredible, incredible... You think you could find... Who can find a better purchaser? Hard, maybe you can find out where it is. Or can we quote it from memory?
So what is said in the Quran, Hasbun Allah wa ni'mal wakeel.
Say that again, Tahir.
Hasbun Allah wa ni'mal wakeel.
Yes, so it's not God is sufficient for us.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what you were saying.
Yeah.
But it's the Quranic word.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful verse. Is the divine in itself not sufficient, completely sufficient for us? It's a very high realization, but because along the way we tell ourselves lots of other things, compromise that knowledge. Is there a better purchaser than God? Oh, my heart.
He buys our
dirty bag of goods.
And in exchange.
And in exchange.
Gives us.
A treasure beyond counting. He takes the melting ice of this mortal body.
And gives us a spring.
And gives us a spring so delicious even sugar would be ashamed of its sweetness.
Jealous of its sweetness, yeah.
Anyway, that's a bit of it. Rumi says that. So, is there a better purchaser for the heart than God who buys our imperfect bag of goods, buys it from us, purchases us, and gives us this treasure, this spiritual treasure, in return? And now, this may sound like a lullaby or wishful thinking, but really, at the heart,
actually, the rest of that verse is: "If any doubt waylays you,
if any doubt waylays you,
look." At the prophets.
Look at the prophets. Look to the prophets. Look to those spiritual traders, the prophets.
No mountain.
No mountain could bear what they've been given. So if any doubt waylays you, look to those spiritual traders, the prophets. No mountain could bear what they've been given. So, and this is so typical of Rumi, and it's not unique to him. It is really the essence of this spirituality, that the divine is that generous. The offer is that great. This is why Rumi was intoxicated with it, and fortunately had a sobriety even greater than his intoxication. But he wanted as many human beings as possible to understand the beauty, the generosity, the mercy of the divine. And that's not different than what Muhammad brought and what Jesus brought and what Abraham, Solomon, David, and other prophets, known and unknown, brought, although it seems like with time the mercy becomes even more explicit, more revealed. What was more latent and implied becomes really unfolded, really, you know, just takes your breath away. There is another page here which we'll also share with you. These are some very random quotes from Rumi that we translated. He says, "You may despair of finding a true friend of God, but since the treasure does exist in this world, consider no ruin, completely empty of treasure. Go to every dervish at random, and when you find the signs of a true saint, keep his or her company regularly. And if the inner eye has not been granted to you, always think that treasure could be in anybody." Or this one. "The mosque, that is the inner awareness of the saints, is the place of worship for all. God is there." So he compares, he describes the inner being of the friend of God as a mosque, as a place of worship for everyone. I'll let you read the others on your own time. Some of them require reflection. Any more thoughts? Any more? Anything anybody would like to share? Yes, Mo. Be loud enough for everybody to hear you.
When you said, offer your heart to God.
To the friend.
God is al-zahir al-bat.
God is the outward and the inward.
The outward and the inward.
And lots of other qualities as well.
So, could I say that every moment is God? And that's
In some sense, if it doesn't confuse you, you could say that. If you say every moment is God, you're still reducing God to something, because moment is just a fraction of time. Right? But that's not what we mean by the present or timelessness. Certainly the divine, if you like, God comprehends all time, it is all time, yes. If you mean that everything that comes your way in this life, we begin by saying, yes, God, thank you. Is that what you mean? I may be a little picky with language, forgive me sometimes. I may, you know, poke at you and, you know, get you to sharpen thinking a little bit and, you know, play with you a little bit.
I appreciate that.
I'm just that way sometimes. You know, ultimately it's the heart's understanding that's important, not our analyzing our language, but the language is important too, to lead to the fuller understanding of the heart. Yes, Tyler.
I don't know, it's a silly question, but for many years I've been struggling There's a human history of the heart, definition of the heart or understanding of the heart. But when we say heart, what it is heart? What is heart?
What is heart?
And obviously, only knowledge which is pure and truthful is the knowledge that you get from the Book of God. The rest is all in here, but at different stages of closeness to the Book of God. So what's your perspective from Quran's standpoint and obviously human history of uses of the heart by all the Sufis and including Rumi of that? Because Quran uses different words for the heart, which is qulub and fawad, and there is also, if I throw, which may not be heart, but aqal. But which one is the heart, which the Sufi needs?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it's a big subject, and not to try to escape from answering it, but it really is a large subject. But you will find in the Quran a real science of the heart, if you look closely, especially if you focus on the word qalb. More than fuad, you'll see there's specific circumstances in which fuad is used. I can send you a paper that outlines these things more specifically, rather than go into all the linguistics right now. But let's just take qalb, and it, you know, that's the basic word for heart in Arabic. And you'll see there's qalb salim, healthy heart, for instance, a very important term. There's a diseased heart, the hardened heart. There's a numbed heart. There are lots of states of the heart. So you could define Sufism or spirituality as the purification of the heart. What I've concluded, what I've come to myself, or the way that I would express the heart, what is the heart? The heart is our organ for sensing relationship and for experiencing existence qualitatively. Sensing relationship. So if you and I can really meet, or any two human beings can really meet, it's through the heart. Or if I can have a relationship with the divine, it's through the heart. So the heart is a knowing capacity. It's not merely our emotions. That's just, you know, a tiny aspect of the heart, and even some emotions don't even deserve to be associated with the heart. So it's not the emotions. It is the core of our being, but not the deepest part of our being, which is the ruh, the spirit. Spirit like a dimensionless point in the space of the heart. The heart is intermediary between ultimate spirit and the self.
Is it an aspect of the soul, or is the, which we call nafs, or is the aspect of the thing which is in our chest?
No, of the soul, yes. Okay. Absolutely. No, it's not. The physical organ is a physical component or a reflection of it, but it's not it ultimately. So the heart is, it's something huge. It's something almost infinite, virtually infinite, in that it, if you want sort of a justification for that, the hadith Qudsi that says, I am in the heart of my faith. Nothing in the universe can contain me, that is, contain God, except the heart of my faithful servant. If you look for me, look for me there. So the heart is big enough to contain the divine. And it's a big and beautiful subject, and I wrote a book called The Knowing Heart, which touches on it. And since that time, I've had a lot more thoughts or deepening reflections on it. But let's say ultimately it's that in us which knows, and knows qualitatively, and knows, when I say knows the universe qualitatively, to sense the significance of our own finiteness in relationship to the infinite, to sense the significance of our humanness in relationship to the divine. This is what the heart can do. To to love another so much that you forget your own self-interest is an aspect of the heart. So the heart is, and they talk about the eye of the heart, and many human beings, especially in the modern world, the heart becomes so numb that the human being is incapable of feeling, sensing the beingness of others. And when you lose that sense, everything becomes a thing. Even people become things. That's what allows tyrannies to flourish, that allows cruelty, because you're only doing something damaging a thing. You're not damaging a living, sensate being. But when the heart is awakened, I swear to God, even the doorknob has soul. Everything has soul. There's nothing inanimate in existence. The whole universe is alive. It is one living thing. The whole universe is. This is Tawhid in our terms. So the heart can know that. The heart can know that the unity, just like these stages we went through, all of this is known through the heart. And through the infinite spirit coming into the heart makes that connection with the infinite and with the divine, and the heart is practically synonymous with the divine, and yet we distinguish it. And these are not things. When we talk about spirit and heart and self, none of these are tangible things. There's a mystery with each one, and this is just a loose way of talking about them, and yet there is some usefulness in distinguishing these things. So we have nafs, which means self in our language, nafs. The nafs goes through stages of transformation as the heart becomes purified. And at the highest level of self, your self is not limited by your body. You see yourself everywhere. You see yourself in another. It's the subtlest state of everything. Only the heart can know that. Only the purified heart can know that. So the whole work of spirituality is to purify the heart, to perceive. And submission and surrender depends to some extent. I mean, people talk about surrender, or they think surrender is a scary thing, or the ultimate sacrifice of everything that you think is important and you cling to. You know, everything prior to surrender is difficult. But surrender comes from perception. Surrender comes when you see what really is. And it's the most, would be the most natural thing. Like you surrender to your beloved. It's not hard, except when your ego gets involved, but then you're not quite in the same state of love as you were before. So, heart's a big subject. Thanks for asking, because it gave me a chance to run through that.
Everything is, I would like to,
yeah. It's just a little article, because the way Fuad and Kalb and Lub, these words are used in the Quran, are very specific. It'll shed a little light on this, but also the Hadith and what the great Sufis have had to say will shed more light. Thank you. So, on a night like this, we do a few different things, and including some zikr, some chanting, and sometimes we sing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you like that idea?
How about only the heart?
Yeah. Could you pass out our song books there? We'll song about the heart. It's called Only the Heart. Can you find what page that is on? 15?
17.
17. The way this is sung, there's a refrain. Camille, could you explain how we sing the refrain in two parts?
Or it's actually the verse that we were singing. So each line of the first two lines is repeated. So it's there's a gem within the mountain, and then there's a kind of an echo repeat with the ladies. There's a gem within the mountain, and then everybody sings. There's a drop that holds the ocean, and the ladies have a little echo. There's a drop that holds the ocean.
Softly.
Yeah. And then only the everybody sings together. So it's just the first couple lines of each verse that we have that repetition.
So we're going to play through the music part once, and then Camille and I will begin to sing it, and you can join
us. Please join it.
Sorry for interrupting you guys. I don't see Acts 17 in this book.
Oh, you may have an older book.
It's there. Like 1-3, 1-2.
Oh, okay. We'll see if there's another, because some of them
Natasha
are older copies.
Natasha will give you an updated version.
The gray ones.
Meanwhile,
the
we'll put that one in the fire.
Well, they're so useful.
Everybody have a page 17.
Inshallah.
So this is something that Sufis do a lot, and they're together. Simple songs. So remember, this one has to be a little bit on the slow side, because it's